much do you remember about the early days of social media? In preparation for this chat, I spent some time scrolling down memory lane on my own feed yesterday. I don't know if the right word is carefree or cringe. Early social media me definitely went hard on the grainy filters, and I definitely posted more than one try-hard artsy photo of my brunch. Well, it might be hard to believe, but one of the biggest social media platforms, Instagram, turned 15 years old this month. Which means it's technically still not old enough to have an account on itself after the social media ban kicks in. But today, 2 out of 3 people on the planet use some kind of social media each month. It has reshaped our lives in maybe more ways than we realise. So I'd love to know from you today whether you think we're better or worse off with social media. With me is Jean Burgess, who's a distinguished professor of digital media at Queensland University of Technology. Jean, when did you first get an Instagram account? Did you?
Do you know what? I looked this up this morning. It was the 30th of October, 2011. So 13 years tomorrow.
Oh my gosh. Happy anniversary, I guess.
Yeah, I guess.
This is your work. This is your what you look at. What do you think attracted people to the app when it first launched?
I think it arrived at a time where there was a few things going on that were kind of coming together at the same time. One was digital photography was like a mere 10 years old for most people. We had these new smartphones that had cameras on them. They were connected to the internet. They could tell you where you were. And there were all of this buzz about these things called social networking sites. So Instagram kind of brought those three things together. It's a blend of the word instant, as in instant photography, like a Polaroid, which was its logo, and Telegram. So it was a way to visually communicate with your friends. That's really what it was.
It's funny hearing Shane Jenneck before Courtney Act talking about 2003, auditioning for Australian Idol and having the phone with the monochromatic screen. It could barely do anything. I think we forget sometimes how quickly technology's evolved, how recent it is that we've had these incredible cameras in our pockets.
Oh, absolutely. And you, as you were just mentioning in the little intro there, there are all of these apps around for the iPhone. You would remember like Hipstamatic was one where, so the idea was you'd take this instant photo with what seemed to be an amazing camera for a phone. Looking back, they are not that great. But then you would apply these filters that would make it sort of look like different kinds of film cameras and different kinds of... So there was this... At the same time, we were like, wow, this is the future. It's amazing. And this is a way to kind of recapture a whole lot of nostalgia for analog technologies, for family photo albums. You'd often put a little frame around it that looked like the photo you'd stick in the album, you know?
That's so interesting. Yeah, this sort of take a photo that's really good and then make it look worse. There was a lot of optimism and wonder, I suppose, around the power that we had with our devices, the immediacy that we could share these things to people that we knew. The mood really feels like it's changed a lot over the last 15 years.
I think that's a bit of an understatement. And yeah, I'd be probably not surprised by what people are going to be texting in. But I want to kind of make the case that a lot of the really delightful and lovely social things about Instagram still are there if you just choose to, like me, I'm really stubborn and I persist in taking photos of things I see on the street or just little moments or beautiful sunsets. But yeah, a lot changed. I don't know if I should do a quick timeline. But
let's go.
Well, yeah. Okay, so 2010, these two guys wanted to launch an app that was a competitor to a thing called Foursquare, which would tell you where the best bourbon joints are, and it was called Burbler. That was not a goer, so they rebranded it as Instagram, and the story begins. A couple of years later, Facebook bought that startup. The two apps kind of stayed separate for a little while, but then eventually Facebook and Instagram, you log into Instagram with your Facebook account, all of the data tracking and advertising and all that sort of stuff associated with Facebook becomes part of Instagram. At the beginning, you would see what your friends posted in the order that they posted it. Now, and even a few years in, you have algorithmic feed. So stuff gets pushed into your feed that you might not even follow, right? And alongside all of that, the growth of the influencer economy and creator economy, and I believe we're maybe going to be talking to a creator, so I'll leave that to them. But it becomes big business. It becomes a worldwide platform for media companies and organisations like the ABC to use to reach their audiences. But all of these issues associated with algorithmic feeds, screen time, addiction, all of that sort of stuff become part of the Instagram story. But that's just the broad story, I guess, of social media.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Jean Burgess, Distinguished Professor of Digital Media at the Queensland University of Technology, talking about Instagram turning 15 and the big changes that we've seen in social media in that decade and a half. One says, I live alone, not lonely. However, I enjoy the voices and input of ABC Radio. I'm social and connected most days. Well, thanks for listening. Ollie in Apollo Bay says, definitely better off without it. Why doesn't our government get rid of it for all of us? I'm 32 and have gotten rid of it all, and I don't miss it at all. Well, one person who now relies on social media for their income is Conrad Benjamin, former high school teacher, self-described politics educator with close to 500,000 followers on Instagram. You might know him as Punters Politics. Conrad, how do you explain to people what you do for a living?
G'day, punters. I believe when I run into regular punters on the street, I think how I communicate it is I'm making politics simple for the everyday punter, just using new methods of communications, trying to help Aussie punters keep focused on what is important in politics and not the well-crafted beauty pageant politics distractions that are fed and we're told is politics.
But you're also like literally making money off this now, which is something that you wouldn't have been able to do 15 years ago.
Well, yes, exactly. Making money off this is an interesting term because Instagram pays me nothing. YouTube pays me something, but most of my money comes from the fact that other punters see what I'm doing, say, hey, I like what you're doing, keep doing it. And that's mostly Patreon. So it's mostly me being able to connect with other people. People see what I'm doing is valuable. And that's what keeps me afloat, really.
So a common argument is that younger people these days are disengaged. They don't care about politics. Is that your experience?
It depends how you define young. Based on my stats, most of my audience is millennial men. And so my operating theory is, you know, people come out of high school, go into uni, they're optimistic, the world's at their feet, so awesome. They finish a degree, get a job, go, all right, let's get a house. And they realize the system is rigged against them. So around 25 to 30 is where my audience really ramps up. That's when they realize, oh, we've got to come together and solve some of these big problems that have rigged our economy against younger people. So, 18, 19, they're still having a good time thinking life's great and could be, but there's some big issues facing them later on.
So one of the big criticisms of social media and just the online space in general is misinformation. You're in this space, you're working in politics. Do you think there's enough oversight of content to ensure accuracy of what people are getting?
To be honest, I think that's the wrong framing and that's the wrong question. I think not put forward by you, but put forward by the industry because they want us talking about monitoring content, like we have to treat people like children and slap their hand and ban people and ban me and ban someone else. And then the tech platforms get to come in and be the good guy and say, oh, but free speech, oh, we're just bastions of free speech. When I actually think the whole problem began with these platforms around algorithms becoming publishers with no accountability, bots flooding the platform to shift the perception about what other people are socially talking about, bots impersonating humans, bots abusing people. Mate, I know firsthand, as soon as you post online something that says climate and change or renewable and energy, the bots flood in. And so I think these are at the core problem. And I think if we're talking about what the government should come in and say yes or no to per post, I think it's a losing battle. And we're just letting big tech skate on by completely unchallenged.
Jean, what's your take on this? How do we regulate these spaces?
Well, I think that the platforms do regulate our speech in lots of ways already, whether it's about adult content, which to prevent young people at an early, too early a stage accessing sexual content, but then also preventing them from accessing sexual health information often. There are very real problems with some kinds of misinformation that can really damage people's health. So that's an area that I think the government's looking at. Our current system of laws is more oriented to mainstream media and formal advertising. And as we've just been hearing, a lot of the more dangerous misinformation is actually being propagated by shadowy organisations that may or may not be associated with formal political actors, using the regular, the sort of guise of free speech and the relatively sort of less more libertarian approach that the platforms have to exploit audiences. But there's not a black and white divide between mainstream media and social media in this regard. There's a lot of connectivity.
We're just talking, like, I think the through line for this chat is just the rapid nature of change. Is there any point in trying to go what the next 15 years looks like on social, or even the next 5 years looks like on social media, Jean?
Well, I think we're already seeing kind of, you know, that period of the 2010s, there was a few dominant platforms that everyone was kind of attracted to and excited about. We're already seeing people kind of dissipate, creators, as your previous guest will tell us, have to work across a whole lot of platforms already. The audience is really, really distributed across and decentralized. Generative AI and AI in general is changing the game. So I think we're going to see just kind of like almost like a dissolving of what we've thought of as a relatively stable social media landscape. And I think we don't know what's coming next, but I think AI is going to be a big part of the story.
Conrad, briefly, are you feeling optimistic about the future of social media or not?
Given big tech's grip and capture of our government and every sort of government that it works with, I think wherever we're heading, it's full speed ahead with whatever these private corporations, however they want to mine our attention or the very fabric of our social democracy to make even more money. And however they can do that, I think there will be almost nothing standing in their way. So I don't have high hopes.
This is your bread and butter, Conrad. I feel bad for you hearing that. Jean, are you feeling optimistic or pessimistic?
I'm a pragmatist. I think I would never give up hope on society, on our culture and our communities. And I think that there are still lots of ways you can use social media to connect with community, to represent yourself, to have a really nice time. It all depends on what you post and what you choose to follow.
Conrad, Jean, thank you both so much for joining me today. Jean Burgess is Distinguished Professor of Digital Media at the Queensland University of Technology. Conrad Benjamin is a former high school teacher turned self-described politics educator on social media. And lots of texts from you. Gina in Mile Creek says, I tend to doom scroll since Reels became popular. However, only when I'm in civilization. I live in remote central New South Wales with data access only available in a certain place on a windowsill. Being on my own, I like that I can access it, but that I love that I can't spend hours on it. Julian in Hobart says, we're worse off in so many ways, but we can't get the genie back in the bottle. I think it's a mistake to restrict access. Another says, I used to defend social media to a degree, saying that despite its problems, it still brought people together. I don't think I can defend it anymore. It's dumbing us down, isolating us, and algorithms promote extreme videos and lead young people to be hateful or self-damaging material. I think we'd be better off without it.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.